47 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. And we're going to be spending most of this hour with, first of all, a good friend to the Morning Show, Carthage College's theater professor, Herschel Kruger, who is here with three of his most talented students to talk about their newest production, which opens tonight. And it is Sarah Ruhl's comedy Stage Kiss, which is one of the most euphorically received and reviewed plays in recent years. I read several reviews last night, and I just couldn't get over how the critics sort of stumbled over each other trying to find words laudatory enough to talk about just how superbly crafted and hilariously funny this play is. And it's one of those proverbial plays within a play. So it is one of those plays that theater folks especially love to do because it speaks to them on a real personal, direct, vivid level. But that doesn't mean you need to be a theater person to really find this play absolutely engaging and entertaining in every respect. So Professor Kruger is here, and along with two of the stars of the show, Macy Jo Mueller and Jordan Horn, who portray the characters of She and He. And also with us is Lindsay Phillips, who's also in the cast, but also the dramaturge for this production. So she did a great deal of research about it, and it actually is going to be doing a pre-curtain, or was it post-show? Post-show presentation, I think, Saturday night. Mm-hmm. So she's here as well to shed all kinds of light on this production and this play. So a warm welcome to all four of you. Glad you're here on the morning show. And it's especially nice because I assume, well, you had a preview performance last night. So.
Yeah, last night we had our first audience in, so we got a feel for what people will react to and how to deal with an audience when you hold for laughs. And we also use the house of the theater, and so moving in and out and around the audience at different points of the play. You do it in rehearsal for several weeks with the fluorescent work lights on in the theater, and then all of a sudden you shift into performance mode, and you got to adjust to that and to the audience being there. So it was a really great start, and it kind of gave the actors their first look at what it'll be like to play with an audience. It was exciting.
Great. Well, that makes me even more appreciative that you all got up early this morning to join us on the morning show to talk about this. Professor Kuger, say a little word about what prompted you to choose this play in the first place, and then we'll bring in Lindsay to talk about her research project.
Absolutely. The year we put together our season, we have a lot of discussions looking at how we can create opportunities for our students. So that's always our first goal. And the other challenging aspect is finding then the right material. Professor McClendon wanted to tell the story of our soldiers who are coming back from Afghanistan in Afghanistan, Wisconsin. We knew it was a heavy drama, and we wanted to match or counter it with something that was, I won't say it was lighter, but it is a comedy, but it does contain some pretty heavy ideas. And so we had to take that into consideration, and then also gender opportunities as well. We have probably 60% of our performers are women and 40% men, so I wanted to make sure we had a few more female characters, which we do in this play. And just Sarah Rule. I mean, you look at all those things, and I don't look at it as it like handcuffing you. It just kind of leads you in a certain direction on what kind of plays you want to work with. So this was a play I had read and I had considered, and, a small list of plays that I keep, on my desk or around, thinking, this would be great to produce, and it just fit perfectly. So the opportunity to direct a Sarah Rule piece, she's one of our leading playwrights in, our new century, and her styles, I won't steal any thunder from Lindsay, have impressed audiences all over, the country and the world, with plays like Dead Man's Cell Phone and Clean House and Vibrator Play and Eurydice. There's something new she does every time, and she captures your imagination as well when you're in the audience or when you read the play. So her works are just, a great deal of fun and a great challenge.
Carthage did Dead Man's Cell Phone a couple years ago, didn't
they? Yeah, that was about 5 years ago.
Wow, time flies. So tell us about, probably our listeners won't even understand what a SURE grant is, but explain what that is and the opportunity which it afforded Lindsay Phillips to explore this play further.
Well, one of the wonderful things about Carthage College is that they promote undergraduate research opportunities for students. And that's across all disciplines. So students in the arts are able to work with a professor and have a topic that they research over the summer. So SURE stands for Summer Undergraduate Research Experience. And this was something students apply for, and I had encouraged Lindsay to do this. And it worked out. So we were fortunate to have that. And in theater, your research person is called a dramaturge, or they take on the dramaturgical duties. And we set up a list of topics in preparation for the play. And her work influenced not just the work we did once we started rehearsal, but she was part of the pre-production work. So she was able to bring her research to the design team, from sets, costumes, properties, and organizing what's needed and looking at the different periods. Because we have three different periods in the play, we have the play Stage Kiss, the world of Sarah Rule's play, of he and she. And then they are actors in the first act in another play called Last Kiss, which is a 1930s melodrama. So you have the play within the play. And then in the second act, they're put into another play called Blurry. And that's set in the early 2000s in New York City, but it's a play that's being performed in Detroit. I'm already making things confusing. But so, you know, there was three periods to research. Mm-hmm. And so she had her work cut out for her. It was a great experience. And we actually went up to the Guthrie in Minneapolis and saw a production of this as well.
Hmm. Lindsay, pull the mic a little closer to you. So had you done anything like this before? Had you ever researched a specific work so thoroughly?
No, I definitely hadn't. And Herschel, like he said, he encouraged me to do dramaturgy for my Sure Grant. And once it started, it was very exciting, but it definitely was learning as I went along.
Mm-hmm. Was this already something you were aspiring to do? I mean, or did this kind of come out of the blue a little bit?
No, it's definitely something that I've been interested in for a while. The dramaturgy and literary management side of theater is very interesting to me. And Herschel knew that I had applied for a few internships in that field for the summer. So he knew that was something that I was very interested in.
Mm-hmm. So what did you spend most of your time doing as you worked on this Sure Grant and this project?
Reading. I spent a lot of time in the library. But I was sort of learning as I went, like I said. So I read the play first, and then I read several other Sarah Rule plays. And then from there, I went into reviews that Stage Kiss has gotten, and then from there I went even broader in terms of looking up melodramas and meta theater, which is the play within a play format, and other subjects that the play encompasses.
My understanding is that this is at least loosely based on a play that came before it by the great Noel Coward.
Yes.
Tell our listeners about that connection.
So I don't believe it's been confirmed by Sarah Rule herself, but I did read in some of my research that the play within a play, The Last Kiss, is loosely based on Noel Coward's Private Lives, in the terms that it's two lovers who are sort of reunited and like fall back into this affair that is unhealthy. Yeah.
So the matter of all these different levels, what did you have to do in terms of helping prepare for the production to make all of that sort of come true and be authentic and real?
I looked up melodramas, and then in terms of design, I looked up a little bit about Art Deco, the art style that was very popular in the 1920s and 30s, and I presented that to the designers, and that can be seen in our first rehearsal set for The Last Kiss. You can see some Art Deco influences, and other things like that, where that would aid not only the designers but the actors in knowing a little bit more about this world that they're creating.
Right. What's it like when you take a hilariously funny play and dissect it? Does it stop being funny?
No, definitely not. If anything, I appreciate it more because you learn more about it. And even as we've been rehearsing, I've found more jokes just because of a lot of what Jordan and Macy are doing and our other cast members are doing. They found levels that I definitely didn't over the summer. So that's been very interesting. And then you just appreciate her work more. Sarah Rule is an incredibly intelligent playwright and writer, and dissecting it only makes you understand her process more.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Professor Kruger, mm-hmm. would just about any play be worthy of this kind of examination, or was this a play that was, in a sense, exceptionally sort of complex and worthy of this kind of attention?
Any play you can have a dramaturge, you know, they can help in a lot of different things. I mean, sometimes they're just used to make sure that you're consistent in your choices and cohesive and honoring the period you're in, and they may work just from kind of a historical perspective. But, you know, Lindsay also made like a packet of research for all the actors, and she gave a presentation at the first rehearsal. She gave presentations during the summer detailing her work with other Sure students, and she'll have a very short lecture and then have a discussion after the play. So I think this play, and many others, lend itself to having someone in this role. And especially when you look at Sarah Rule's work, you say it's a comedy, but I think it takes a pretty deep look and in a perspective into what makes a healthy relationship, and it takes a little time to get there because she doesn't beat you over the head with ideas, but she presents this play, and one of our students who's in it, I talked a lot about the play, and I loved how he summed it up, because he said, it's a cautionary tale. Hmm. So that was Christian Aldridge, who's a senior and is playing one of the other principal roles in the play. But I think that's really where she's going with it. It's, you know, it's didactic, but it's not saying this is what you have to do. It's laying out a scenario for you, and based on what you see and how these people interact with each other, you make your own conclusions about what a healthy relationship is and what commitment is. And I think what she tells you is it's not just about monogamy, but it's about fulfilling a person's other needs, you know, romance and friendship and you know, being a support person and just all those things. So I think it is a really positive spin. And not to be fooled by something that's fast and easy or the illusions that we sometimes have in relationships.
Let's talk with Macy Jo Mueller and Jordan Horn, who are he and she. First of all, say a word about why they're called he and she.
I think she wants to keep them almost like the everyman. So they represent men and women and different people, you know, from all walks of life have this, you know, challenge of being in a relationship. So it's not just these two people in a drama. I mean, it's not Mary and Joe, because she doesn't want to limit, you know, who this could be. I think it's. That's my interpretation, and maybe Lindsay could answer that as well, or the actors, because they've had to live in the roles. They start to learn more about them than I do as the director.
Right. Is this something Sarah Ruhl has done before, for instance?
No. Most of her other plays, the characters have specific names, but she did say in an interview that she did want to keep it general so that anyone can sort of step into those shoes.
Right, and this could be anybody, in mm-hmm. a sense. So... So, Macy Jo Mueller, tell us about She.
She. It's been a blast working on She. And to just kind of touch on what we were just talking about with the vague name, you know, I'm doing this project as my senior thesis for my theater performance major. Mm-hmm. And I've been spending a lot of time scoring my script and, you know, really delving in. And as I was writing in my script, I would write, you know, she does this to control he. And at that moment, you know, there was a moment I realized, is she talking about the character in Last Kiss, or does she mean she? Mm. And so it really blurred the line between, you know, actress and the role she's playing, which is a big thing that she struggles with, you know. She's kind of... You know, she reconnects with he and sees a greener side of things than the relationship she's in right now. And I think she gets really caught up in the possibilities and not wanting to miss out on, you know, the possibilities that she hasn't explored yet. And that's kind of what she's struggling with in the play, which I think is a very relatable topic, not only in relationships, but just, you know, with every choice we make, we want to make the right decision and we want to get the most benefits we can from each decision we make.
Right. And it's hard not to wonder what benefits or pleasures are you bypassing when you make one choice, which leads you away from other potential paths.
Absolutely.
What about the character of he, Jordan Horn?
Yeah. So he... I gotta say, he's just a troubled guy. You know, in the beginning, he comes in, and they both get cast as counterparts, and we have to kiss in the show. And it kind of, you know, reignites the flame that we had. And we're both in relationships at the time, but he is more of he's ready to move on to the next girl, you know, and it's, he has a lot of different things going on in his head, and he talks about little things from his past and his parents, and it's deeper when you really look at the text versus just seeing the show once and so forth. But yeah,
how much of the backstory is actually on the page in terms of what these other relationships are like and what has gone wrong and what went wrong with your own relationship? Or wait, were you married?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
We were not married.
Okay. So, how much of that do you have to sort of construct yourself out of your imagination versus how much does Sarah Rule sort of put in place?
Sure. I think there's a lot in there. It's little stuff and you know, you can look past it really easily, but there are these little like things that you'll say that the characters will say, and it's like, wow, you know, that's probably like a deeper meaning to that.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
There's little hints everywhere. There's never just like, this is our backstory, but as the play progresses, even, you know, when our relationship diminishes again, even in that scene, you're finding more about their past and their history, and they're kind of, I think, re-examining things as they go too. So they're kind of learning as the audience learns, mm-hmm. in a sense.
In the structure of the play, and why she writes, you know, a play within the play, and then in the second act writes another play within the play. Those plays help fill out the backstory of their relationships because they comment on it, and there's parallels that are made that then draw things out. So there's all these little signposts along the way, and their relationship gets caught up in the relationships of the characters they are playing. So it's mm-hmm. very intentional. So it helps move the central plot and the central story forward. And it also comments on and gives you the deeper understanding of who they are and what their relationship was and what it means now, and how it's affected the relationships that they're in. She is married and has a daughter, and he is in a new relationship with a school teacher. So it brings all those things out, but you have to follow the signposts, and I think we've, you know, done our work with that.
What is it like for the two of you, who I know must know each other pretty darn well, being in, you know, a number of different classes together and probably productions together as well. What's it like to play opposite one another in such an intimate sort of work, having your own history, as I presume, good friends and frequent classmates and so on? What does that feel like?
It was a little odd at first. I've never done any sort of intimacy on stage or anything like that. So going in, I didn't really know what to expect, but Jordan and I know each other, and we've been friends, and the whole cast, you know, it's really important to have a cast you can trust to, you know, be there, support you, and not make fun at you if something goes silly. And so it's been a great environment to work in, a very safe environment. But I think, you know, it's developed along the course of the show, just like the whole entire show has, just like getting comfortable with each other and, you know, really trusting each other and just, you know, letting it happen.
Mm-hmm. Very good. What about the matter of doing comedy seriously, in the sense of, I haven't seen this play yet, but from all reports, it's hilariously funny. What has been sort of the key to make it as funny as it can be?
It's just trying to keep it real and truthful, mm-hmm. is really what it is. And that, the truthfulness that's in the play is the funniest part.
Right.
Mm.
Is because it's all these little human flaws and awkwardness, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think of the play as a lot of bits. I think it as is these real situations, and people will do funny things, and they'll go to extremes when they have a strong need and they want to accomplish something or get something or affect someone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do kind of crazy things as human beings, and that's what we see. So I think the comedy comes out of the truth of the of the actors trying to, you know, fulfill those objectives and the strong needs that they have. And, of course, the great writing, the situational writing. I mean, if you play the truth of the scene and you know, have the high stakes that are needed for it, the comedy just falls out of it. Mm-hmm. So we didn't create a lot of bits. You know, there's some physical comedy that it has to happen. You know, so the necessary moment is that she picks up her purse and everything falls out of it. So that's written in as a bit. Or, you know, there's falls or a couple other little physical things that have to happen. But after that, it's, you know, the comedy is about how they deal with each other to solve the immediacy of the moment.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite reviews of several that I read was in the New Yorker, which said that this play is instantly recognizable, yet wholly original.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it draws on these kind of past traditions and genres and so on, but does so in a really fresh way, makes it sound like it's quite an exciting blend of old and new. Lindsay, what are you planning to do with your presentation on Saturday night? What are you going to be focusing on?
Well, I'm going to be focusing on sort of a broad overview of what the work I did over the summer and how I went about that process. And then we're going to open it up into a talk back with the audience to get some of their ideas on the themes of the play. I mean, we have a ton of them, but it's always great to hear what people who are watching the play think. And then if they have any questions for me or for the actors or for Herschel, they'll be welcome to ask them.
Very good. Just a quick final question.
Sure.
What difference has Lindsay made for you as director?
Well, she took a lot of work off my desk. But she, you know, her work also helped me understand the play better. Because when we first started working on the play, I'd say, God, this is really funny, but where's the meaning here? And is there something deeper? And, you know, I thought there were things, but it's sometimes fun to throw that out, and then we both come back and talk about it. I mean, I had some ideas, but you want to be able to bounce things off of someone, and you know, it helped me come to an understanding of you know, like my core action statement. I also teach directing, and so I always make students write these, and they hate me for it. But you know, I still have to come up with it, and I have the luxury of several months of planning. I always make them write them like within a week or two, mm-hmm. and it takes time. It's part of a process. Those ideas have to kind of incubate, and you know, you have time to throw some different things around. So that was really important. She also, you know, helped, like, just create spreadsheets of tracking actors and tracking costume changes and props and even following the scenes. And there's this mm-hmm. running joke that, why does everybody have the name Millicent? Because there's a friend Millicent, there's the daughter Millicent, and then the maid's name is Millicent, or who they call Millie. And so there's all these little things. And at one time we got into this long discussion, like, who's Millie? Who's on stage right now? We were in a production meeting, and Lindsay had that information for us. She kept us all straightened out because we were trying to figure, what is she wearing? What is she doing? And so we had this back and forth with the costume designer on who is the Millicent on stage now in Act 1, Scene 4. So
it sounds like terrific fun. The play is going to open tonight and run tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday afternoon at 3. And then the following weekend, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday mm-hmm. night, 7:30 p.m., I assume, in Wartburg Auditorium.
It's at Wartburg Auditorium. People could call 262-551-6661, 551-6661 for the Carthage Theater box office, or email at theatertickets@carthage.edu.
Excellent. Stage Kiss, about to open at Carthage College. And in the cast, Macy Jo Mueller and Jordan Horn. Thank you for being here. And Lindsay Phillips, the dramaturge. And, of course, the director of the production, Herschel Kruger. Always great to have you here.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
What's next on the theater department's schedule?
We have our dance concert coming up the third week of November. I think that is, I got to get the dates right in my head, but I think it's the 12th, 13th, 14th. Or is it, I'd have to look at the calendar.
Right.
So we have a wonderful dance concert with our dance faculty, and then there's two student pieces that are also in the show that were part of last spring's student dance work. So we always bring a couple of those forward to show with our professional faculty directors,
excellent.
Choreographers.
Well, best wishes with everything that's coming ahead for the theater department. Part two of the morning show coming up now. Thanks again to all of you for joining us today. This is the morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio.
I like nothing more than to be introduced to an important person about whom I've never heard a word. And that's really the case with the New York Times bestseller, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, which introduces us to the very important figure of Thomas Dent Mütter, a very important doctor and surgeon from the 19th century, who, as much as anyone, helped to revolutionize the way that medicine was practiced, and especially the way in which surgery was practiced. And he was a gifted and in some ways incredibly flamboyant man, and he had a wonderful way with words. And so what he said about the profession of medicine is absolutely captivating, as is this book about him, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine, written by the award-winning author Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. And she is born and raised in Philadelphia, where much of the story of Dr. Thomas Dent Mütter unfolds. And he is still very well known in the city of Philadelphia, not as well known as he should be, given his importance. And so I am so happy to have had the opportunity to read this endlessly fascinating book. And now I have a few precious minutes to speak with the author, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, about this book published by Avery, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
And I'm happy to be talking to someone who lives in Philadelphia, where I happen to have a brother who lives. And was I overstating it when I said that the city of Philadelphia well knows the name of Thomas Dent Mütter better than the rest of us do?
Absolutely. It is the home of the Mütter Museum, which is a museum of 19th century medical oddities. And so if you grew up in Philly, this was a place you went to a lot on field trips and school trips, and it just became a part of the culture of being a kid and growing up in Philly. And it wasn't until I left Philly that I realized there was anything unusual about it, and that not every kid grows up with a medical oddity science museum in their childhood. And that's how I first became interested in learning more about the man who founded it.
Absolutely.
Of which little was known.
And I want us to talk about that. I want to give you maybe 40 seconds to just list a couple of the really interesting things that are found at that museum. I mean, I think it's important for people to appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, there's Madame Dimanche. She's a woman who had a horn that started growing from the center of her forehead. She's actually from Dr. Mütter's original collection. We have the death cast and conjoined liver of Chang and Ang, the famous sideshow act, the conjoined twins, which gave us the term Siamese twins. They have a 9-foot megacolon that was extracted from a human being who is known as the human balloon. The megacolon is so popular that they actually sell a plushy version of the megacolon in their gift store, so you could take it home with you. You have the Hurdle Skull Collection, which is skulls collected from all over the world to disprove the concept of phrenology, the idea that you can tell people's character through ridges on their skulls. You have, limbs in jars. The thing I couldn't handle was the wall of eye trauma, essentially a wall of eyeballs of which awful things have all happened to them and how we would treat such a thing. It's a pretty, I wouldn't suggest, I've had now 2 book release parties at the museum, and I always say I save a lot on catering because no one wants to eat after visiting the museum.
Right. Of course, the thing that's interesting is that museum, it brings his name to the public, but in a sense it doesn't necessarily help us understand just how important he was and what a revolutionary figure he was. Explain how the state of medicine was in such a state that Dr. Mütter found it so deeply objectionable. I think most of us don't know enough about early medicine before it really began to enjoy
right.
Scientific rigor.
Exactly. I mean, even the tools. I mean, that's one of the things I must have thought was so frustrating, is to have an innate instinct towards things like germ theory, right? The idea that diseases can be and infections can be spread through, contact with an infected surface, whether that's a hand or a tool. That was not proven, really, until the invention of the modern microscope in the late 1800s. Mutter died in 1859. So he, you know, his belief that you should wash your hands and tools prior to surgery was seen as a feat and weak. One of his colleagues at the university he taught at, Miggs, with whom he clashed a lot, used to be offended at the idea that doctors would wash their hands prior to seeing patients because, quote, it insisted that doctors were not gentlemen because all gentlemen were clean men. So the idea that doctors were actually taking stances against washing your hands and tools gives you a clue of what 19th century was like. They didn't have electric lighting, so all surgeries were done by candlelight or sunlight. They didn't have ether anesthesia. All surgery patients were awake during their procedures. And in fact, a part of the service was men would be paid to hold you down on the surgical table, both to keep you still during the surgery, but also to prevent you from running away. You did not need a license to practice medicine. You did not need a degree to practice medicine. You literally could just say you were a doctor, hang a shingle outside of your house, and begin putting leeches on people. It was a real wild, wild west. And during Mutter's lifetime, you know, the changes that made for what we know and enjoy as modern medicine today began to fall into place. And Mutter himself was at the forefront of it. You know, he really viewed medicine and practiced medicine in a way that I think today we would all love to be treated. And this was, you know, decades before some of his theories would be proven. So he was really forward thinking and, you know, a great hero in my mind.
You connect him to the city of Paris, France, in several different ways.
Yes.
How important was that in terms of shaping the kind of doctor that he was? I mean, living and working in Paris, was that an important contributing factor in the groundbreaking work which he did?
Absolutely. Back in the 19th century, you know, if you were going to study medicine, you could not really be an exceptional doctor, you know, one who worked in the highest stratas, unless you were already born into a wealthy class, because wealthy people would only trust, you know, other wealthy people at that time period. You wouldn't take someone whose background you didn't know to examine your wife. You know, that was just seen as completely implausible. The only field in which you could really come from the background that Mutter did, Mutter was a poor orphan, and succeed and make a name for yourself, was surgery, because it was something where skill would outweigh any other factor. You know, if you were going to have your leg cut off and you were awake during the surgery, you kind of didn't care if that guy knew your dad. You know, what you cared about was, would it be done cleanly, as with as least pain as possible, and would you survive the surgery? In order to be the best surgeon possible, Mutter, you know, kind of tricked his way over to Paris to study with the best surgery being done in the world at that time period, and came across the field of study which he would become known for, which over there was called operations plastique, and what today we would know as plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery. And this was an area of surgery that was brand new to modern medicine. Obviously, if you were having surgeries done on you while you were awake, you would only want that to happen if it was a life or death situation, essentially elective surgery, right? Wanting to help fix a deformity or disfigurement by choice was not something a lot of people made unless they were certain that that the outcome would make their life better and happier, and that they would survive the surgery. And Mutter saw plastic surgery for the first time in Paris and knew immediately that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to come back to America and reach out to these populations of patients that were completely underserved. I mean, the severely deformed back then were literally categorized medically as monsters. That was a medical term, in the way that idiot was a medical term. And he saw these people as human beings. You know, he was very sick throughout his his entire life, and especially through his childhood. And he knew what it was like to be a patient and knew what it was like to not be treated well by the doctors who were tasked with healing you. And he knew that this was a population that did not get the respect it deserved.
Right.
So he went in back to America and did revolutionary work. The surgeries that he did and invented were so forward-thinking that there's some of them are still being used today.
We should mention that early in his life, he actually received some very good care from physicians. I think it was something where they were sort of spelling out very clearly what his future was likely to be physically, and he so appreciated the care he received that that's one of the things that inspired him to pursue a medical profession.
Absolutely. That sort of clarity and transparency was not a part of 19th century medicine. People rarely sought the help of doctors and only in extreme situations. And doctors, you know, again, if you're performing work on a patient without any sort of painkiller or anesthetic, it's going to be excruciating for that person. And you're just going to have to ignore their screams and cries to get the work done that you know needs to be done. So there was a big gulf between patient and doctor. And doctors were sort of trained to sort of ignore their patients. And Mutter just took a stride against it. And you could see that in the work that he did. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, most apparent metaphor is he was the inventor of what we know to be the modern recovery room. You know, prior to that, if you had surgeries done in a surgical clinic, they just put you in sort of an unwashed wagon and rode you home over the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia. Mutter was appalled by this. You know, he was doing these very delicate surgeries, and he didn't want infection to set in. He didn't want the stitches to be disrupted by rattling in a wagon, and he insisted that the college that he taught at, Jefferson Medical College, build recovery rooms, and they refused. They just did not see the reason for it, and Mutter was so adamant that this be done that he himself used his own money to rent a floor above a restaurant and would move his patients into that floor and watch over them along with the help of his students. So that today, that seems like common sense. Of course you would do that, but back then it was just unheard of. So that's an example of the humanist philosophies that Mutter put into practice that really put the patient and the patient's care front and center instead of the infallible, you know, dictations of the doctor, which was definitely the way 19th century medicine, you know, moved.
It's especially fascinating in your book to read about the battle over anesthesia and the fact that and Dr. Mutter did not invent anesthesia, but he was one of its most persuasive champions. And your book outlines the reservations that most other doctors had about anesthesia, in particular the fact that some doctors relied on the on what the patient would tell them through the course of the surgery, and the idea that of the patient being out cold during the surgery. How are we going to talk to them then? but for other reasons too, some of them just could not open themselves up to this notion.
And
it's fascinating to read of Dr. Mutter's tenacious insistence that this was the only humane way to do surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking, you know. In researching Dr. Mutter's marvels, you know, I'd always thought that scientific progress was sort of, you know, a march up a mountain, you know, innovation building upon innovation. And when you would have something like, you know, ether anesthesia surgery being, you know, essentially invented, that doctors would flock to it. Oh, my God, this is clearly the next thing. To realize that there was a battle against it, that hospitals banned it, was shocking to me. But again, when you view it through the lens of the 19th century, it began to make more sense. You know, one of the reasons you spoke about was that doctors throughout time had performed surgeries on and learned from their patients who were awake during the surgeries. So if you were talking to a patient and he began to sort of fade away and you realize, oh, this patient is at risk of bleeding out, and if I don't stop the surgery now, they're going to die on my table. If the patient is already unconscious, how would you ever get that information before you had the medical tools that we have today? Another reason was because of the lack of standardized medicine. You know, it's another thing I always took for granted of. I don't expect the Tylenol I buy in New York City to be different than the Tylenol I buy in Chicago. But back then, you know, your jar of ether could have varying strength depending on who made it or where it was made or when it was made. So the surgeries themselves were with a very unstable chemical. And the last one was sort of the most surprising to me, which was before germ theory was really proven, doctors did not wash their hands in tools, and the death rates of people who had surgery under ether versus surgery while they were awake were pretty much exactly the same, which is shocking. You would think that a thrashing person on the table would cause a lot more deaths than someone who was calmly knocked out. But it was the infections after the surgeries that were the real killers of 19th century medicine.
Mm. And it didn't matter how the surgery was done, in a sense. I mean,
right. Exactly. And so it was really the doctor's choice. If the doctor says, it doesn't seem to affect their death rates, they die at the same rate, whether or not they're knocked out enough, and I don't trust this chemical, and I've done surgeries with people awake the whole time, it's my choice whether or not I want to do this. Then it kind of makes sense. But of course, as a patient, you would think you would choose to be knocked out every time. Unfortunately, at that time in medicine, we were not given the option of whether or not we would want that service. But, those sorts of things just made researching Dr. Mutter's marvels such a pleasure. I really, fell in love with that time period and the debates and the, discoveries that were happening. Everything was so new, and you have people like Mutter who had a vision. Mutter was fastidiously clean. He knew innately, and perhaps from being a patient himself, the difference between a clean doctor and a dirty doctor, and knew that being clean, fastidiously so, is going to help your patient in the long run. But his theories on this wouldn't be proven for 50 years after his death. It's incredible what he was forced to endure for things that would later be, proven with a microscope or proven with an X-ray.
A man truly ahead of his time who made life better for so many people.
Yes.
And your book tells the story so brilliantly. The book, again, is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a New York Times bestseller, now available in paperback. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, its author. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, congratulations on an absolutely spectacular book. I loved every page. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
On Monday's morning show, we look forward to a return visit from Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clawson Center. He joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events both here and around the world. On Tuesday's morning show, you'll hear my conversation with best-selling author Homer Hickam. He's probably best known for his memoir, Rocket Boys, which recounts how he and some of his schoolmates explored the wonders of rocketry. Despite growing up in a very small and unpromising little mining town in the South, he went on to a career with NASA. He is a very gifted writer, and his most recent book is a novel called Carrying Albert Home, the somewhat true story of a man, his wife, and her alligator, based at least loosely on events early in the married life of his mother and father. A beautiful novel. We'll talk about it on Tuesday. Wednesday, we will preview an upcoming performance of a beautiful choral work called The Cry, being presented by the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. Thursday's morning show will include a conversation with Stuart Stevens, the author of a book called The Last Season, in which he recounts his efforts to reconnect with his elderly father over a shared love of Ole Miss football. And it is a very, very poignant and intriguing story indeed. 1 week from today, we'll preview the Lakeside Players upcoming production of To Kill a Mockingbird. We'll be talking with several different people involved in that production. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Cloudy, windy, and cool today. Rain developing, a high of 60 degrees. Cloudy, windy, and rainy tonight. Maybe even thunderstorms, a low of 58 degrees. Saturday, cloudy, a 50% chance of rain, especially in the morning with a high of 66. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.